It's with pleasure then, brothers and sisters, we call upon Brother Alan Clark to conclude our studies over these 2 days from the visions of Zechariah and his subject, the four chariots. Brother Alan. My dear brothers and sisters, there's another change in the theme. And I turned and lifted up mine eyes and looked, and behold, there came four chariots out from between two mountains, and the mountains were mountains of brass. Four chariots to accomplish the conquest of the earth, to destroy the apostasy. That was the theme of chapter 5. To subdue the nations, the great mountains that stood in the way of the antitypical Zerubbabel. The chariots had a connection with the work of the temple. But before we consider that, let's just make the point that these four chariots are the same as various symbols that are used in the scriptures. The four carpenters or artificers of chapter 1 and verse 20. They are also, we are told in this chapter, the four spirits of the heavens in verse 5 of Zechariah chapter 6, where it says, "These are the four spirits of the heavens." They are the same as the four cherubim of Ezekiel chapter 1 and verse 5. They are the same as the four living ones of Revelation chapter 4 and verse 6. The word translated beasts should be translated living ones. The word isn't the same as the beasts of the nations in the later chapters of the book of Revelation. And they are the four standards of the camp of Israel, enumerated in Numbers chapter 2. Here is an Israelite community in warlike manifestation in the subduing of the earth. And the connection with the temple is given to us in the first book of Chronicles, chapter 28. There we see that among the instructions for the building of the temple and the arrangements related to it, David had prepared with all his heart an example that wasn't followed by the people who returned from Babylon from their captivity. They allowed the opposition to cause the work to cease, and it's the restarting that is the work of the prophets Zechariah and Haggai. In chapter 28 of the first book of Chronicles, and at verse 18, amongst the things that David had prepared with all his might, he wasn't allowed to build, therefore he did everything that he could in preparation for it. Not like those who returned from the captivity. But amongst the things that he had prepared, verse 18, "And for the altar of incense, refined gold by weight, and gold for the pattern of the chariot of the cherubim that spread out their wings and covered the ark of the covenant of Yahweh." There is therefore a connection between the chariots of Zechariah chapter 6 and the cherubim in the most holy place. The position in the most holy place relates these people to immortality. This is the most holy state of immortality to which we are called. So that is the significance of the four chariots that Zechariah saw. It's the same as all these things, and we could spend all night talking about these representations of the militant arm of Yahweh in the subduing of the nations. This one of chapter 6 goes on to say, they came out from between two mountains, and the mountains were mountains of brass. The two mountains of brass are the same as the thighs of Daniel chapter 2. Let's go and have a look at Daniel. We've seen it before, but it's worth looking at again. The basic fundamental prophecies that we all understand are the basis for other prophecies that continue that same theme. And although we readily recognize that the belly and thighs of brass relate to Greece, it is perhaps not quite so widely recognized that the thighs are the kings of north and south that came out of that kingdom of brass, the Greek kingdom of north and south. This image's head, verse 32, was of fine gold, his breast and his arms of silver, his belly and his thighs of brass. And while we're in Daniel chapter 2, we confirm that the symbol of a mountain is of an empire, or at least of a kingdom, because verse 35 says that the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. And we can see how the king of the north and the king of the south developed in chapter 11. It's surprising how clear is the language of Daniel chapter 11. We tend to run away from it because of the detail of the prophecy about events of which we are ignorant. But look at the early part of the chapter and see just how clear it is. Verse 2, we're in the time of the Medes and Persians. And now will I show thee the truth. Behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they all, and by his strength through his riches he shall stir up all against the realm of Grecia. And we have in that verse, brethren and sisters, the confirmation of our interpretation of the methods of the image down to the belly and thighs of brass. It is a matter of exposition relating to the history that developed from that time to confirm that the fourth metal related to the power of Rome. But verse 3 goes on to say, and a mighty king shall stand up, that shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And here we have the great power of Alexander. It spread way over to the east as far as the river Indus. And verse 4 goes on to say, and when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken and shall be divided toward the four winds of heaven, and not to his posterity, nor according to his dominion which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up even for others beside those. In other words, it was going to be divided into four that would not be his descendants. And when he died, it was divided between his generals. There were probably about over 30 at the start, soon reduced to about 15. And it took about 50 years before the situation described in verse 4 was developed, when there were only four divisions of the Greek Empire. But Daniel, and the Spirit through Daniel, concentrates on two of those divisions in Daniel chapter 11. Verse 5, and the king of the south shall be strong, and one of his princes. And in verse 6 we have the other division on which this chapter concentrates. The king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement. And on the chart here, we have faithfully represented that interpretation. The two mountains of brass to the north, to the south of the land of Israel. In verse 40, after the kings of north and south have disappeared from the record, when the Roman power came on the scene, and the Roman power is described in verses 36 to 39, all of a sudden at the time of the end, verse 40, we have another king of the south and king of the north. And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships, and he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. The king of the south of history was a foreign power, a Macedonian power, centred in Egypt, to the south of the land of Israel. Ruled over by the Ptolemies. The king of the north of history was a foreign power, a Macedonian power, the centre of whose dominion was Antioch, to the north of the land of Israel, in the land of Syria, but whose dominion stretched way over to the east, at least in the early part of his dominion, as far as the river Indus. And so in the latter days, in the time of the end, we have a king of the north and a king of the south. And so we look for a foreign power in Egypt opposing another foreign power in Syria to the north. We believe that the king of the south is the power of Britain and her commonwealth and nations and former Commonwealth nations. And the king of the north, we don't believe is Saddam Hussein. We believe it's Russia. It is only Russia that will have the dominion over to the east and to the west, as Gog had, as prophesied in Ezekiel chapter 38. But the point that needs to be stressed is that the image is not complete until the south is defeated. The whole of the image has to be under the Babylonian head at the time of the smiting of the image upon the feet. And that is indicated in verse 42. He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. The power of the south will be defeated, and the king of the north will think that he has the whole dominion in his hand. And then the God of heaven will intervene. That detail of the victory of the king of the north is not indicated in Zechariah chapter 6, but it is in Daniel chapter 11. And so these chariots come forth between these two antagonist powers, the king of the north and the king of the south. Verse 5 tells us of Zechariah chapter 6, and the angel answered and said unto me, these are the four spirits of the heavens. These are no ordinary armies, brethren and sisters. They are the four spirits of the heavens. Not by man's army. Not by the power of flesh. But by my spirit, saith Yahweh of hosts in verse 6 of chapter 4. It is by the four spirits of the heavens that this conquest is accomplished. And it says that these are the four spirits of the heavens which go forth from standing before the Lord of all the earth. And I was careful this morning to place the position of the two anointed ones and the lampstand at the time of the resurrection. Because in verse 14 of chapter 4, it says, "These are the two anointed ones that stand by the Lord of the whole earth." This is the glory, the joy of the resurrection, having been given immortality. It is the lampstand which will give light to the world throughout the age of the millennium. But the particular time that Zechariah points to in verse 14 of chapter 4 is the time just after the resurrection. Because chapter 6 and verse 5 talks about these four spirits of the heavens going forth from standing before the Lord of all the earth. And they go out to conquer the earth. Now, when we dealt with chapter 1, we looked at the four types of horses. In verses 2 and 3 we have the description. In the first chariot were red horses, and in the second chariot black horses, and in the third chariot white horses, and in the fourth chariot grizzled and bay horses. Those of you who still have the chart, there are still one or two copies left at the front if anybody hasn't got one and can get there in time. If you look at the chart, we see that in Zechariah chapter 6 verses 2 and 3 we have the second line on the chart, of which there are red horses, white, black, grizzled, and they're described as bay, but that is not so much a colour. The word amutsim in the Hebrew indicates strong rather than a colour. So we have four colours used in these four chariots of the verses 2 and 3. The colour red is related to bloodshed. The colour white to conquest by the sword. Brother Thomas extends the idea of conquest in righteousness to conquest by the sword. Although Brother Mansfield, taking hold of this word Labanim, translated white, as having described the disease of leprosy, he interprets the white as pestilence. The black, the Hebrew word Shikorim, is by our three brethren, is interpreted as famine and is fairly clearly correct. The grizzled, the idea being of spotty, the Hebrew word barudim, the idea that I like is especially white spots, this idea of a loathsome disease. And Brother Thomas interprets that as the sword and pestilence upon the nations. These are not the character of the horses or the horses, but the effect of those horses upon the nations against which they come. The horses that pull these chariots, we have further indication in Zechariah, are probably the nation of Israel. Zechariah chapter 10 and verse 3 says, "Mine anger was kindled against the shepherds, and I punished the goats, for Yahweh of hosts hath visited his flock, the house of Judah, and hath made them as his goodly horse in the battle." Verse 5 5 says, "And they shall be as mighty men which tread down their enemies in the mire of the streets in the battle. And they shall fight, because Yahweh is with them, and the riders on horses shall be confounded. And I will strengthen the house of Judah, and will save the house of Joseph, and will bring them again to place them, for I have mercy upon them, and they shall be as though I had not cast them off, for I am Yahweh their God, and will hear them." And so it seems that the nation of Israel are to be used in the subjection of the nations. If we go back to chapter 9 of Zechariah, and at verse 13, we have another figure which indicates that the nation of Israel is going to be used in the warfare involved in the establishment of the kingdom. Verse 13 says, "When I have bent Judah for me, filled the bow with Ephraim, and raised up thy sons, O Zion, against thy sons, O Greece, and made thee as the sword of a mighty man, and Yahweh shall be seen over them." So it's the nation of Israel with the saints guiding them in their work. "Yahweh shall be seen over them, and his arrow shall go forth as the lightning, and Adonai Yahweh shall blow the trumpet and shall go with whirlwinds of the south." So we believe that the nation of Israel will be involved in the subjection of the nations to the rule of Jesus Christ. Verse 6 says of Zechariah chapter 6, "The black horses which are therein go forth to the north country, and the white go forth after them, and the grizzle go forth toward the south country." This is further confirmation, I believe, that the two mountains that have to be dealt with first are the mountains of north and south, the two mountains of brass that we have in the chart before us. And the confirmation in other prophets that there is work to be done in the north and in the south comes, first of all, in the north, in the prophecy of Micah and chapter 5. Micah chapter 5 and verse 4 says, "He shall stand and feed in the strength of Yahweh, in the majesty of the name of Yahweh his God, and they shall abide, for now shall he be great unto the ends of the earth." And this man, the one born in Bethlehem Ephratah, this man shall be the peace when the Assyrian shall come into our land, and when he shall tread in our palaces. Then shall we raise against him 7 shepherds and 8 princes of men. And they shall waste the land of Assyria with the sword, and the land of Nimrod in the entrances thereof. Thus shall he deliver us from the Assyrian when he cometh into our land, and when he treadeth within our borders. Here clearly is a judgment brought upon the north, the latter day Assyrian who comes down upon the land. And work related to the south is indicated in the prophecy of Isaiah and chapter 19. Isaiah chapter 19 and verse 20. It's a chapter about the destiny of Egypt. "And it shall be for a sign and for a witness unto Yahweh of hosts in the land of Egypt. For they shall cry unto Yahweh because of the oppressors, and he shall send them a saviour and a great one, and he shall deliver them. And Yahweh shall be known to Egypt, and the Egyptians shall know Yahweh in that day, and shall do sacrifice and oblation. Yea, they shall vow a vow unto Yahweh and perform it. And Yahweh shall smite Egypt," by the northern invader, "he shall smite and heal it. And they shall return, even to Yahweh, and he shall be entreated of them, and shall heal them." And so the north and south are dealt with. That is the immediate conquest that is needed. As we come back to Zechariah chapter 6, we see that in verse 7, that the bay went forth. The word translated bay is the word amutsim, which indicates strong rather than the colour. And they go forth and sought to go that they might walk or march to and fro through the earth. And he said, get you hence, walk to and fro through the earth. So they walked to and fro through the earth. Having dealt with the north and the south, the attention is directed westwards, the land of the enemies too, where the apostasy had been established upon its base. It is there that the attention is directed next after subduing the area around the land of Israel. That is shown to us in the book of Revelation in chapter 14. Because the gospel having gone forth to the nations and the opportunity having been given them to submit to this king in Jerusalem, we read in verse 8 of Revelation chapter 14, and there followed another angel saying, Babylon is fallen, is fallen. Babylon was in the plain of Shinar. And it's the Shinar that we were looking at in the 5th chapter of Zechariah that it's directed to. Babylon is now established, not in Saddam Hussein's territory, but in Rome. And so the attention is brought against them. Babylon is fallen, that great city, because she made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. And the third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, if any man worship the beast and his image and receive his mark in his forehead or in his hand, the same shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out without indignation, without mixture into the cup of his indignation, and he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment ascendeth up to the aeons of the aeons. It's until the 1,000 years commences, not during it. And they have no rest day nor night who worship the beast and his image, and whosoever receiveth the mark of his name. And so the attention is directed to the nations of Europe. Further detail is given us in the 19th chapter. We've already referred to it, but perhaps we can just pick up a couple of verses to remember the theme. Verse 14 of Revelation 19, and the armies which were in heaven followed him upon white horses, clothed in fine linen, white and clean, and out of his mouth goeth a sharp sword, that with it he should smite the nations, and he shall rule them with a rod of iron, and he treadeth the winepress of the fierceness and wrath of Almighty God. He smites the nations. He makes war against them, using the nation of Israel, who by this time have been brought into the new covenant. And so the earth is subdued by the going forth of these chariots. Verse 8 of Zechariah chapter 6, then cried he upon me, and spake unto me, saying, behold, these that go toward the north country have quieted my spirit in the north country. And we have the situation of the nations at rest. The conquest is complete. And the visions of that long night of Zechariah are finished. He'd have much to ponder, brethren and sisters, of those things that he had seen. It was interesting earlier, a brother was telling me that he has noted in his Bible a quotation from Eureka relating to the subject that we've been looking at over the last couple of days. And I was going to quote it anyway. And I'm reinforced in the rightness of that quotation by what that brother told me. Brother Thomas in Eureka says, "The four carpenters, the four chariots, the four spirits of the heavens, the four cherubim of Ezekiel, and the four living ones of the apocalypse are all symbolical of the same class of agents, the eternal spirit, post-resurrectionally corporealized." Corporealized is made bodily like him, made into a body. "The eternal spirit, post-resurrectionally," so it's after the resurrection, "made into a body in Jesus and his brethren, and constituting in the aggregate," you have to think about every word with Brother Thomas, but if you can just follow the words as they come up, every word has a meaning and it builds up into a glorious climax, "constituting in the aggregate," in other words, all together, meaning Yahweh Elohim, the glorious and fearful name of deity, taken from Deuteronomy chapter 28 and verse 58. "The manifestation of deity in the chariots and horses is the last of the symbolical visions granted to Zechariah, illustrative of the time of the end." And so we've seen the end of the visions. But we have a bit more time. So we'll just take an aspect of the following verses of chapter 6 without going into detail, because they seem closely associated with the visions that he has seen. All the visions from chapter 1 and verse 7 through to chapter 6 and verse 8 have all happened in one night. But verse 9 of Zechariah chapter 6 says, "And the word of Yahweh came unto me, saying." So it's at least the next day. And we could just imagine the conversation between Zechariah and the other leaders of Israel, and with the people that were involved in the building, the encouragement that was involved in these visions that he had seen. How they would be spurred on to complete the work. This was the object of the visions that he'd seen. And then, shortly afterwards, we don't know just when, people came from Babylon. And he was told to accept of them silver and gold, verse 11, and make crowns, and set them upon the head of Joshua the son of Josedek, the high priest. Now the word is plural in verse 11, but some translators make it singular in verse 14. "And the crown shall be to Helam, Tobijah, and Jediah," these people that come from Babylon, "for a memorial in the temple of Yahweh." So we've got circlets, as it were, made into a crown that is placed upon the head of Joshua, the son of Josedek, the high priest. And verse 12 says, "And speak unto him, saying, Thus speaketh Yahweh of hosts, saying, Behold, the man whose name is the branch, and he shall grow up out of his place, and he shall build the temple of Yahweh." There is then a man whose name is the branch. Joshua, the son of Josedek, is the immediate receiver of that title. The word translated branch is the word tzimak. And in verse 12 it says, "The man whose name is the branch, and he shall grow up," or shoot up. The margin says, "branch up from under him." The idea is of a shoot, a branch. And the phrase in the Hebrew in verse 12 connects the two. The two words are there. The branch is tzimak, and the sprouting up is another part of that same word, so that the two words are very closely associated. So here is a branch that springs up, a shoot. And for cross-reference, the same word is used in Zechariah chapter 3 and verse 8, that Brother David was dealing with. The branch there is Tema, just the same in verse 8 of chapter 3. I will bring forth my servant, the branch. It's the same as in Jeremiah chapter 23 and verse 5 and 33 and verse 15 that Brother David took us to when he was dealing with that vision. It's also the same as Isaiah chapter 4 and verse 2. There's another word used for branch that comes in chapter 4 that we didn't have time to deal with, and we wanted to get the main theme of the final part across. But now that we have the time, we go back to Zechariah chapter 4 and verse 12. I answered again and said unto him, what be these two olive branches which through the golden pipes empty the golden oil out of themselves? The word there is the word Shibboleth. You'll perhaps remember that name. It's a well-known Hebrew word, probably one of the best-known Hebrew words. Shibboleth. It was the test of the Ephraimites as they came back from the battle in the wood of Ephraim over on the east side of Jordan, when they tried to get back home, and when their enemies got there before them, they caught them at the fords and told them to say Shibboleth, and they had different accents in those days and they couldn't say Shibboleth, they said Sibboleth, and so they were caught out. The idea of Shibboleth is of ears of corn or branches from mounting up or spreading out. It's also translated and has the meaning of a stream and sometimes a flood, but here we have the one occasion where it is translated a branch. They are branches which through the two golden pipes empty the golden oil. In fact, the interlinear Bible with the Hebrew and English with the Strong's references in it translates that word branches clusters, and that has quite a reasonable sound to it, because it's the olive oil coming through these branches, clusters, through the golden pipes and into the bowl that feeds the lampstand. Another word translated branch is the word netzer, and it's the word that is the basis of Nazareth, and it's there that we have the basis, I think, for the interpretation of what is said concerning the fact that Jesus lived in Nazareth. He shall be called a Nazarene, has to do with the word branch translated netzer, the Hebrew word netzer. The word netzer is masculine. The word Shibboleth, incidentally, is feminine in verse 12 of chapter 4. It means a slip, a scion, that's S-C-I-O-N, don't use it very much nowadays, do we, that word, or young sucker of a tree, selected and reserved for planting, and which when planted required to be attended and guarded with care. And so the young Jesus being brought up in Nazareth was very appropriately being brought up with great care, attended and guarded with great care as he grew up to maturity by his parents in the place called Nazareth, after the word netzer. The word netzer occurs in four different places. If anybody wants to know about them, then come and see me afterwards. We ought really to carry on. And so back in Zechariah chapter 6 and at verse 13 we read, even he shall build the temple of Yahweh. So this branch, this one whose name is the branch, and of course it's the Lord Jesus Christ, even he shall build the temple of Yahweh. There is a literal building described by Ezekiel. There is also a spiritual building that we were looking at when we were looking at the stone, and as described in the first of Peter chapter 2. You'll remember that there was a foundation, that we were as lively stones as part of that building. And then there is the chief cornerstone, the head of the corner. So Jesus is the beginning and the ending of the spiritual building, and he will build the literal temple. Not he himself, of course, just the same as Solomon didn't actually build the temple himself. He will have others to do it, and he'll bring the Gentiles in as part of that work, we believe, from some of the prophecies that we have. Even he shall build the temple of Yahweh, and he shall bear the glory. We come back to this manifestation of Yahweh. The glory of Yahweh upon this one who has overcome first of all in himself and then brought many sons unto glory to join with him in the glory of that age. And he shall sit and rule upon his throne, and he shall be a priest upon his throne. So he's both king and priest. We've seen these two offices brought together frequently in these visions of Zechariah. He is a priest according to Melchizedek. He is a king and a priest. And so we contemplate the glory of the kingdom that will then be established. It says the council of peace shall be between them both. So many times in ages past there has been rivalry between the king and the priest, but when those two offices are united in one person, the council of peace will be between them both. He will both be the great high priest and the king of the age to come. All nations are going to learn the ways of righteousness and truth. All nations are going to have the benefit of his rule, and those that are of the flesh will resent that rule because it will be strict. We find that some ecclesias are not liked in the brotherhood because they are strict. The flesh is still the same in the kingdom, brothers and sisters. It won't change. It will have a different environment, and so it will be easier to know the way that we should go. Part of our problem nowadays is that we don't know what is right sometimes when we're faced with a choice. In that day they'll know. But still the flesh will not like to be told what to do, just the same as we don't like to be told what to do. And finally, at the end of the 1,000 years, the restraint will be taken away, and there will be a rebellion against this glorious rulership that has been established. And we want to conclude by looking at the last words of Elpis Israel. I found it remarkable to think, to read this just last week, and he says, in the last paragraph of Elpis Israel, and here we see another example of the perception of Brother Thomas. Oh, brothers and sisters, get the benefit of his wisdom. He isn't infallible. You sometimes won't agree with him, but get the benefit of the perception that he has and the spiritual insight. He says, during the 1,000 years, their nation of Israel, will consist of three clusters: Christ and the saints, righteous Israelites in the flesh, and those who die accursed. But when perfection comes, there will be but one class, and all will be immortal. You'll notice that the book is called Elpis Israel. The book is about the nation of Israel. And it is of that nation that there will be three classes. But when perfection comes, there will be one class, and all will be immortal. And the book of Elpis Israel is divided into three parts. The rudiments of the world. An exposition of Genesis chapters 1 to 3. The raw material from which the kingdom will be established, brethren and sisters. He then goes on in the second part of the book to talk about the things of the kingdom and of the name of Jesus Christ. The third part of the book is the kingdoms of the world in relation to the kingdom of God. And having come to the end of his contemplations, he comes to the end of that purpose, which is completed. Let's go first of all now to the book of Job and chapter 38. Just to set the background to what the final words of Elpis Israel are. You'll see it has a relevance to what we had to say. We've been looking at over the last day, the couple of days. Job chapter 38 and verse 4. Where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare if thou hast understanding. Do you know the answer to that, brothers and sisters? He was in the book of life, of the Lamb slain. He and all who are counted righteous in that day will have been written in that book of life since before the foundation of the world. Where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare if thou hast understanding. And then, Brother Thomas, having come to this final climax, when all are made immortal, he says, the purpose of God in the formation of the earth will be accomplished. He had that purpose right from the beginning. He could see the end right from the beginning. And the headstone of the creation, having laid the foundation in the first act of creating the heavens and the earth, the headstone of the creation will be brought forth with shoutings, crying, grace, grace unto it. Now, minds go back to that fourth chapter where we have the further interpretation of that passage of Zechariah. You'll remember that we interpreted it before. Who art thou, O great mountain? Before Zerubbabel thou shalt become a plain, and shall bring forth the headstone thereof, with shoutings, crying, grace, grace unto it. There was to be a completion of the temple in the days of Zechariah, and the headstone thereof would be with rejoicing, crying, grace, grace unto it. When the kingdom is established, there will be the headstone of that creation, crying, grace, grace unto it. And then in the final completion of all things, a great marvel, brethren and sisters. We know that he knew the end from the beginning. He has been working out. He was working it out in the time of Zechariah. He is working out his purpose out now. And it will not be completed until death has finally been abolished in the earth, and the headstone of the creation will be brought forth with shoutings, crying, "Grace, grace unto it."